No, B8 to res. Batteries, batteries. Together, together, together. Me was trying to save time. Bamba clap.
Hello and welcome to Britnology, the show about Britain and why it's like that. And may I add, on this occasion, Booyakasha. I'm Milo Edwards and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, Nate Bethay.
Hi, it's me. Yeah, we're going to talk about a figure that is well known to Brits and perhaps, well, less well known to Americans. And I have to admit that I'm not confused by Ollie G's popularity and or Sacha Baron Cohen's character's popularity, but because of the period in which this was at its apex of popularity, I can recall encountering it as a teenager in America and being so incredibly confused.
Yeah.
And now, as an adult who's lived in Britain for over 5 years now, going and encountering it again, I think I understand it about 5% more. Not that I can't understand the slang or the fucking way he talks,
but the whole thing,
the one thing I will say about Sacha Baron Cohen is that because of the popularity of the Borat films in America, particularly the first Borat film, he's much more of a known quantity to the point where he couldn't really do the Borat approach in America anymore because too many people recognized him. So in that regard, because of that popularity, his earlier stuff was then more people learned about it. But all I can say is that my first encounter with Ollie G was back because Madonna put out an album in like 98, the album Ray of Light, that was like a big, big, big comeback for her and had tons of huge hits on it. And so for a while, her subsequent stuff was also being very prominently featured back when MTV, VH1 played music videos more.
Yeah.
And she put out the song Music in 2000. And in the music video for the song Music, Ollie G is the limo driver. And it's Sacha Baron Cohen playing Ollie G. And like, it's just, I remember watching this as like a 15 or 16 year old in America and be like, what? Who the fuck is that? What's going on here?
It's the fucking dialogue at the start in the limo. It's great. I can just imagine how confusing that would be to an American teenager. Just a short burst of Ali G.
And just no context. Because remember at the time, Madonna was married to Guy Ritchie and was living in the UK and was in like full Britannia Tia mode. And so she spoke with a bit of an affected English accent at the time.
Yeah, this was the era when, you know, they were seen leaving a hotel with a strap on in a clear plastic bag.
Yes. And so... Yeah, that immediate exposure, it was just sort of like, is this guy part of the story of this music video for some reason? Is he supposed to be Middle Eastern? Who is this guy? Why does he talk like that? And it wasn't really explained. I mean, it wasn't necessarily meant to be explained. But I feel as though, taken out of the context of Sacha Baron Cohen's subsequent fame,
if you
show what the clips you've shown me to an American who wasn't necessarily like exposed to it before, they would probably say, why does he talk like that? What the fuck is going on?
What the fuck is going on? Yeah, I mean, also, I think we'll get into this, but like some of the clips we watched, you're like, oh, this is of its time.
Yes, it is. Woof.
But it's sort of, I don't know, I always have such, in the broader sense, I always have like such kind of like mixed feelings about Sacha Baron Cohen. another one of Cambridge's proud sons, but he's done so much stuff that's like so like great, like bordering on genius, but then also Bruno, like, you know, there's just like where you're just like watching, you know, like the first Borat movie, there's so many moments in it that are like him talking to like US senators and stuff, and it's like, this is amazing, this is like groundbreaking. But then like, yeah, then it's like, Bruno, what if a man was gay and also Austrian?
Yeah, what if a gay guy was hugely flaming? Yeah, we've never had that as a comedy trope in America ever.
Yeah, well, the entire joke is he's gay. Imagine that. And I remember even when I watched Bruno, which was probably like around the time when it came out, so, you know, I'm like 16, 17, I don't know, whatever. And even at the time, I was like, oh, man, this sucks.
Yeah, it sucks really bad. I mean, I would say for me, of all the clips that we watched, the one that I think really nailed it down for me, that he's very, very sharp and talented as both a comedian and kind of like not improv explicitly, but in the sense of being able to like follow the contours of a thing to find a joke, was the interview he did with the Beckhams.
That was great.
Like specifically the riff about if the fittest, the best footballer gets the fittest girl, does that mean that
Sporty Spice is going out with someone from Scunthorpe United?
Baby Spice is going out with someone from Scunthorpe, and Victoria Beckham is like that, like basically like that's my friend, that's rude, like that's offensive, and he's like, yeah, I know. So you're saying like she's, because Baby Spice is fit. So what you're saying is this, you're saying Scunthorpe's a bad team. That's fucked up. And like that's, it was such a good turnaround moment. I was just like, damn, this guy is actually really, really, really good. Borat to me, I saw it in theaters and it was really funny at the time, but I also think, like you said, it's very of its time.
Yeah,
and I don't know
yeah.
if I would find it as funny if I went back and watched it now.
Yeah, there's definitely things where the most like insane, I think the stuff in it now that reads the craziest is like the really like anti-Semitic stuff in there, but like he is Jewish, so he can kind of, he can carry that. Yeah, it's definitely like, yeah, I mean, like stylistically it's very dated, but yeah, there's some moments in just like the guy's face when he says, my wife made this cheese with milk from her tit. It's just like, I'm just like, yeah, there's a certain, you know, there's some jokes you'll grow out of.
I think the naked wrestling scene where he's yelling at the guy in Hebrew and the guy's yelling back at him in Armenian, and it's, they just added in subtitles, but it's completely improv of them just speaking in mutually unintelligible languages.
I fucking wept the first time I watched
So I mean, we're here to talk about Ali G. And I think the thing that, okay, here's the thing that really, to as an American, and also when you think about the distance between when this was like being made versus now, is that the idea of a white dude trying to sound like a British Jamaican guy is so just not a thing that exists in the United States, not in the same way. Like, if you want to envision a white guy who basically exists as a kind of like, I'm basing my identity around appropriating what I perceive to be like cool rap black culture, like all you had to do is go to an Eminem concert and you would see both Eminem perform doing that, and also all of the guys who look like him in the audience also doing that, which is not to say that like there aren't people who just are fans of, I mean, like it's not by default that every white person who likes rap music is Vanilla Ice, you know what I mean? But it's just more that like we have a kind of way that that's coded when you think about the sort of I don't know if you remember this because you would have been probably in grade school and it's a long time ago, but the Offspring song Pretty Fly for a White Guy or whatever, that kind of that concept exists, but the way it manifests here is different, and the way that he's kind of created this character is different.
So to me
it just, I'm going to be honest with you, it's funny, the interviews are funny, the encounters with people who don't realize he's fake are funny. A lot of it kind of just seems like minstrelry. I'm being real with you. It just kind of seems like that to me now. And like, I'm more than happy for you to disagree with me, but some of the stuff where it's like the movie clips and some of the things from him, like sort of the asides of him, just like, you know, the way he deals with his hangers-on and whatnot with the Staines gang or whatever, like, it's kind of, it's just, it doesn't, because there's not that immediate identification. I've never met a white guy from like middle class suburbs in Britain who talks like that.
Oh,
that's not a stereotype. That's not an archetype I've encountered. Yeah.
I think it's less common now because it would be considered like weird, more like it would have a bit of a like, not sure if that's all right kind of. I think there are a few, and I'm not necessarily saying that it's not, I don't know. It's of its time. That we can certainly say. I think that if you look into the sort of, I guess, like the stated markers of Ali G, like what is Ali G supposed to be? And I say this as kind of like I'm pretty neutral on Ali G on the whole. It wasn't really something that I was particularly into. I did see the Ali G film when it came out, but I wasn't like a massive Ali G head in a way where I thought Borat was much funnier. But I think the fact that I can tell you what Ali G's actual name is.
Is this supposed to be like Alistair Graham or something?
Alistair Leslie Graham, yeah. And he's from Staines, which is like, you know, it's like Slough. It's like a very, it's very funny it's a very particular, because like there's also by contrast, there's like a kind of like white guy who grew up in Peckham and all of his friends are black, who talks like that, but in like a more authentic way, because sure. like he went to that school and like he kind of yeah. he grew up yeah. with that vernacular. And so Ali G is kind of, it's supposed to be a parody of a kind of like suburban middle class white guy who's like aping that kind of aesthetic, which I think was more of a thing in the 2000s, in that like
in
I definitely
the 90s
knew,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I can remember this stuff from growing up in a basically a white flight suburb of Indianapolis, where like kids whose parents bought them BMWs, acted like this, you know, formed gangs, things along those lines. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And so it's definitely like it is sort of aping that kind of thing. And I, there were definitely like people like that when I was at school. But I sort of feel as though also, you know. Who am I to say whether it strays into the whether it strays over the line of just kind of like mocking black culture? I don't know. It's not really for me to say. But I think that if we're taking it as like sort of stated goals, it's mocking that type of guy. But whether or not it kind of does that appropriately, you can.
And also, I'm looking at it from the perspective of someone who's, I'm not familiar with that culture at all in terms of like the sort of Britain and white suburban Britain versus like Black Britain culture. I live in Peckham, so I live in one of like demographically the blackest parts of the UK. But like this guy is, it's about a goofy white guy kind of faking, pretending to be a what you'd call like a road man, like basically like a guy who's, yeah, you know.
Because I think, God, I've just seen a picture. Ali G giving a commencement speech at Harvard in 2004. Not even Sacha Baron Cohen, but Ali G. Amazing. So supposedly, at least according to the internet, he's based on Tim Westwood.
Fair enough.
Late of this parish, a man we have discussed at length. Because if you haven't heard the episodes where we've discussed Tim Westwood... how did Tim Westwood come up? We've talked about him on a number of episodes.
We talked about My Ride UK.
Yeah, yeah, we did. And I think he's come up since then. Tim Westwood, bad guy. But if you've never seen Tim Westwood, it's the big dog. Yo, dog, your car is fucked up. We've got to change out your bitch. Yeah, it's sort of like that. And that kind of thing, like how like Ali G always calls women bitches, but regards it as like non-derogatory, is like, that's definitely, yeah, it's aimed squarely at Tim Westwood.
I'm thinking about the have you ever seen the movie Hustle and Flow?
I've seen, yeah, once, like, but it was one of those ones, you know, when you're like 11 and it's on TV and you catch half of it late at night. It was one of those situations.
Yeah. Side note, my wife said that when years ago she dated a Swiss German guy, that they watched it together, and even with the English language subtitles on, like on an English language film, he just had no idea what the fuck they were saying. Like none of it. And he was a fluent English speaker, but like if you're not used to someone doing Memphis vernacular, like you're just not going to get, you're not going to understand it. Yeah, Tim Westwood to me is interesting when you think about like Tim Westwood is just like, well, in America they had Exhibit, so who are they going to use? This guy who's already probably probably about my age when the show started, you know, who's just like, yo, dog! Yeah.
I saw such an amazing post where it was like the list of all of the evidence in the Epstein case that had been released, and obviously it was like Exhibit 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then someone just posted it and went, no, not the Pimp My Ride guy.
So Ali G is based on, is supposed to be making fun of Tim Westwood.
Yeah. And if you want to feel old, I had to explain that to my girlfriend.
I mean,
she's only a year and a half younger than me, but you know what? It makes a difference.
Generational difference, you know what I mean? I appreciate you clarifying that there's not a problematic age gap happening there.
No.
But apparently there's a problematic Tim Westwood exposure gap.
Yeah. There's a difference in Tim Westwood exposure, but crucially, there is some problematic age gaps when it comes to Tim Westwood.
Tim Westwood, like, I don't want to make a joke that trivializes the fucked up shit that he did, but like, it is interesting to me.
Or like, allegedly did, but there have been some pretty nasty allegations about Tim Westwood as regards sexual misconduct.
And I'm not aware of a comparable phenomenon. Maybe it's just because it was never reported, but like the degree to which it feels like you're constantly hearing these sort of like posthumous sex abuse scandal revelations about radio DJs in this country. Like that is a thing. I mean, or I mean, television personalities make sense, but like specifically Tim Westwood, John Peel, you could kind of, I mean, like, Savile's a bigger character than that, but like that, entertainers who are not
Savile,
like,
was the kind of guy who even other guys in the 70s were like, whoa, you're fucking a lot of kids, Jen. Maybe slow down.
I
mean,
like I said before, I know I referenced it in a previous episode, but I'll say it again. The whole thing about like, you do anything to pretend you're young to keep your like youth rail card, and it's got Gary Glitter in the ad from like the early 80s. And it's just like,
I mean, it is funny. The difference with someone like Glitter is I don't think it was as much of a, like, everyone in the business knew Gary Glitter was up to that kind
of
stuff.
I don't think that he
wasn't up to it to the extent that someone like Savile was.
And I think he did it later in life, much more to a greater degree later in life when it was far more criminalized. And crucially, apparently fucked around so much that he got imprisoned and then deported from Vietnam for doing it. And at that point, it's like, okay, there's no denying this guy is... he's a child abuser. But as far as I'm aware, like, the Tim Westwood connection, I don't know if I ever really clocked that. Like, it was never really made that clear. I guess looking at Ali G as a foreigner, I just assumed that this was a type of guy that people could identify. He's a send-up of a type of guy that people had encountered, and that as such there were like white dudes in Britain who between sunglasses and hat and, you know, facial hair, came across as like, well, maybe halfway Middle Eastern, dressing in like, I guess, like Echo and stuff like that, you know, like Mark Echo fucking like Tommy Hilfiger and a lot of the like American like FUBU, the kind of like American brands that were identified as like clothing that rappers wore, endorsed and stuff like that, and then just apparently talked. You have to understand, to the uninitiated person, what he says, the way he talks is almost unintelligible.
It's challenging
because
there's
so much
slang.
He's
using like loads of like specifically Jamaican slang as well, like airing on the... It's like it's so Jamaican to the point of like it kind of diverging from a like what you would call like multicultural London English or whatever.
My wife's best friend is like Jamaican, born and raised in Jamaica, lives in Jamaica now, and like... this sounds more like if you put her in a room with another Jamaican person than it sounds like anything I hear on the street where I live.
It's like I think certain like that there's like an extent to which, because there are so many Jamaicans who've been like quite prominent in black culture in the UK, that like certain amounts of Jamaican slang have like permeated that kind of like multicultural English, if you want to call it that. But then there's like Jamaican stuff that like only really Jamaicans say that. Ali G definitely kind of it does vary. But I think, again, casting my mind back into the annals of you know, Britain in the early 2000s or late 90s, there was I think there was like more of a like sort of like Jamaica philia. I don't know, in terms of like you had people like Sean Paul and Shaggy and stuff who are very popular and like that kind of, whereas now that's kind of faded quite a lot.
Yeah.
But at the time that was like a more prominent thing that people associated with sort of black culture and music, I guess.
I'm trying to think in the United States. I mean, obviously you have Jamaican artists, the most famous Jamaican artists in America, you know, in the olden days would have been people like Bob Marley. But then later on, like, I mean, Shaggy is Jamaican American. Sean Paul is Jamaican. Shaggy actually, like, weird trivia that some people who remember his sort of like, because he had a pretty big hit in the 90s, but then he had obviously with It Wasn't Me, he had an even bigger hit in the early 2000s. But Shaggy.
Constantly having to explain to people online that Shaggy didn't do anything. It was all Ricardo Dussent.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Rick Rock was the guy who was telling him the story, and then Shaggy was just. telling like, just pretend it was a different person.
Yeah, Shaggy was his lawyer.
Yeah,
he was like, you don't say shit to the cops.
The hidden verse from that song is Rick Rock just being like, this is my lawyer, dog, you know I'm going to jail. Shaggy had a hit with Boombastic in the early 90s, but then obviously he had a bigger hit later down the road. But he was in the Marine Corps. A lot of people don't realize it, but Shaggy, like, famously, like, recruiters try to be like, oh, well, Shaggy was a Marine. Like, you can be a success in music if you join the Marine. And Shaggy's like, if you ask him about it, he's like, man, I fucking hated that shit. It sucked so bad. He's a Gulf War veteran.
Wow.
They did a MTV Cribs with Shaggy, and he actually had his, like, shitty old fucked up, like, you know, cathode ray tube TV that he kept because he's like, this was, you know, the TV from like right after I got in the Marine Corps. I got my first apartment when I first, and he's like, I just want to keep it as like kind of a reminder of like, you know, where I got, where I came from in a way.
Imagine you're like the Iraqi soldier who got slotted by fucking Shaggy. That's incredible.
Hilariously, Shaggy was like, yeah, but I don't think he was like in a combat job. And he was just like, it was literally over in 3 days. We just spent like months doing nothing in Saudi Arabia. And then all of a sudden we're like, oh, we're at war. And then it's like, all right, 4 days later, it's over. But yeah, like bringing it back, talking about Jamaican music in America, there has been, but I think maybe not as much because there's a significant amount of Jamaican like migration to the US, but it's just not as like kind of ubiquitous in America. Like, put it this way, there are places in America where there are a lot of people, either immigrants from Jamaica or people whose, you know, parents, grandparents immigrated from America or from Jamaica, but it's not as a percentage, it's relatively small.
Yeah.
Amongst Black Americans.
Yeah, whereas huge numbers of Jamaicans and other West Indian people came over to the UK because you could. I mean, and we all know what happened later on as regards to the British government and its very normal policies.
As a quick explainer for Americans who may not know this story, Brits know this because it's been in the news, but basically, there was a time not that long ago where if you were...
Up until like the mid-70s?
You could travel on your parents' passport if you're specifically British Commonwealth citizens of countries that were, you know, sort of in this grouping had British subject or British citizen passports, and your children could travel, your minor children could travel on your passport. They would just be like a stapled-in addendum. I've seen my grandmother's old British passport when she and my mom emigrated to America.
I used to travel on my mom's passport when I was a kid.
Yeah, I don't know how recently they got, because when I was a little kid, I had to get my first passport to move over to Germany when I was 5. But
yeah, I think America's not allowed this.
Probably,
but on a British passport, you could travel on your parents' passport like into the 2000s. I got my first passport when I was about 11.
Wow. Yeah, and so the situation was a lot of people came over, their parents had documents, they emigrated with their small children to the UK. These people grew up, worked, spent their entire lives in the UK. They had never gotten British passports. They'd never gotten, because they'd never left the UK. They'd lived their entire lives here, basically since they were small children. And the British government coincidentally destroyed an archive of historical landing cards from all the ships that had ferried people over when they were recruiting throughout the present or former colonies to bring people to work in jobs repairing Britain post-war. And after that landing card archive was destroyed, then they were like, all these people are in this country. They don't have documentation. We should start deporting them or denying them health care because they can't prove their citizenship. And because the...
A more sane country might have taken the approach that, you know, people who've lived in a country for like 50, 60 years, maybe regardless of what documentation they do or don't have, you can probably grandfather that in.
But the Brits love nothing more than like, oh, I'm terribly sorry. I wish there was something that we could do. Sadly, the computer says we have to kill you, so you're going to die. Like it was creating this plausible deniability, like, oh, sorry, we just simply don't have it.
And then of course it turned out that every single one of these people came here legally.
Yes.
And in a lot of cases, people were eventually given their right to stay in the UK, but via a long and traumatic purpose of many people did get deported temporarily.
Many people had their passports cancelled while they were abroad.
A lot of people died because they were denied access to medical treatment because they were no longer a British citizen, so they could no longer have access to the NHS and all this kind of stuff.
And so basically, one of the ships that was famous in this era as like a passenger ship bringing people over from the West Indies was a ship called the Empire Windrush. And so people refer to this grouping as like the Windrush generation, people who were small children during the like post 1945 emigration wave that happened here, but that were caught up in this. And so the whole Windrush scandal, when people talk about it, is that these people were often, many of them were deported to their deaths, in the sense that like they were returned to countries they hadn't been to since they were basically toddlers, and they couldn't get health care, they couldn't get housing. Some of them were like murdered because they were like robbed, all sorts of horrible things. And it was all just very, very arbitrary. And the government slow rolled doing anything, and is also slow rolled compensating them. It's really, really bad, and it's part of a sort of like I don't know, a general kind of anti-immigrant thing where they use little procedural stuff like this to just be as cruel as possible. So that's the shortened version of it. But that's the thing being referred to. And so yeah, bring it back that like that to me, I think maybe the weird disconnect is that like I don't know a ton of Jamaicans, but I know enough Jamaicans in real life that seeing this as someone who isn't exposed to what, like, you know, the sort of like British equivalent of guy who thinks he's Eminem or Eminem himself in 2001 be. It just seems a little weird. But like, I'm not trying to say that's the universal value judgment.
To me,
it's a little...
But it's very over the top. And even at the time, it was very over the top. And I think, so obviously now, I think, you know, when things have moved on, because also like the type of guy has changed. I mean, like you look at like Ali G in the show and he's like, he's really into like jungle music, mm-hmm. which it like at the time very was kind of like and sort of stuff like jungle and garage was one of those really interesting things where like it certainly had an element of it that was like black music, but it was also like there were like a lot of like famous like white producers of it as well, and it was sort of more so than, whereas I guess in something like American hip hop at the time, Eminem was much more of an obvious outlier and novelty.
Yeah, absolutely.
As like a white guy doing black music, like stuff like garage and jungle and so on was like very mixed.
Yeah, and I think in the UK in general, my impression was that there was more of a kind of like, it's weird. I know a bit about British music, like popular music from let's say the '70s through the 2000s. And I am taken aback by how much more kind of like, if you look at a band like Massive Attack, if you look at a band like fucking UB40, if you look at a band like, Haircut 100 or Christ Level 42, like there just were more, there was black music, white music, people working in bands together. It's not that it's better. It's just more like there's like a value judgment saying that like, oh, Britain is emphatically therefore less racist than America or whatever. It's just that like there was more of that. Like people forget that MTV basically didn't play black artists until like 1983. Like color line stuff was really hard drawn in America, in music, in popular music, in how stuff was marketed in general. And so, yeah, I guess you can't look at it and say, okay, well, this is trying to be one thing, you know, that we recognize, because yeah, it's representing a thing that's real in Britain, but for us it played out. I mean, you guys didn't have Disco Demolition Night, you know what I mean? You didn't have it was literally I mean, David Bowie like humiliated the, like, not really, but he kind of embarrassed one of the guys from MTV like in an interview on TV about this, basically the guy being like, well, what's the, you know, teenager in Minneapolis going to think about these artists? And David Bowie's like, well, I imagine that they might be of interest to a black teenager, you know. It's sort of like implying in that guy's kind of like sleight of hand, basically saying like, well, the teenager to me means white kid kind of thing. Like that was the default in a lot of ways, still is in America.
Heaven forbid there's a black teenager in Minneapolis, you know.
Yeah, I was gonna say, maybe his name, it might be like, I don't know, like some kind of royalty, Rogers Nelson, maybe Prince, you know? do you have like the history of Ali G? Because like, I guess in a way, if I'm not wrong here, like this, it's kind of the thing Sacha Baron Cohen became famous for, like became known for.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, he first appeared as Voice of the Youth on Channel 4's The 11 O'Clock Show in 1998. And then subsequently he had the Ali G show in the early 2000s, which is where you get the Posh and Becks interview from. That was actually done for Red Nose Day, I believe. Yep. It was like a comic relief special, but like that was like a comic. We watched another interview where he introduced Jacob Rees-Mogg, a very like alarmingly young Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Who just seems very like
alarmingly young and alarmingly old at the same time.
Yeah, awkward in a way that like, where's the Tony
Probably
Ben?
Younger than I am now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Tony Benn one, by comparison, is very funny because Tony Benn just like kind of challenges him on the dumb shit and like he's like not rude at all.
Yeah.
But he's not like just pretending he didn't hear it.
Well, what's amazing with the Tony Benn one is about halfway through he realizes that it's a joke. And then he starts laughing. At first, he's like, well, you can't possibly say that. You can't refer to women as bitches. It's inappropriate. You know, what sort of person are you? And then like it suddenly just dawns on him when he like keeps starting up. He's like, Oh, I see. And then like Tony Benn just starts like kind of like laughing along with it.
Smoking a pipe the entire time, speaking in this accent that just feels like it should be preserved under museum glass.
Oh yeah, powerful vibe. Powerful vibe. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of elements of this which are just like truly, you know, time capsules.
So if you're not familiar with Tony Benn, British listeners will be if they listen to our podcast, but Tony Benn was one of the most prominent socialist politicians in Britain. In many instances, Jeremy Corbyn has referred to him as kind of like his political mentor. Benn was kind of the bête noire of a lot of like labor right and the sort of, I don't know, like Tories in general that just see him as this sort of like bumbling idealist. But I don't know. He had pretty solid principles about stuff. And in general, I've never read anything that wasn't by a hack that made him out to seem on balance like worse, you know, like more bad than good.
Mm.
Like, but it's just very interesting to put those two together in the room. And like the fact that he was able to is very funny to me.
Yeah, well, this is kind of, there was a lot of like really crazy shit on TV in Britain in this period where I think that, you know, people would like, if you were a politician, you would get asked on like kind of stupid TV shows, but which were fundamentally not a joke.
Yeah.
And so like in a way where I think now it just wouldn't happen, or like it wouldn't happen to a politician who wasn't like completely irrelevant, like a real, like a Lember Opik, you know, type situation.
But then you think about the Pedo Geddon episode that we watched, and it's like, that also, those people didn't realize they were being pranked. Like,
yeah, that was wild. But I mean, that also was a much more self-seriously presented show than Ali G. Sure. Like, the actual content of it was insane, but it was presented in the tone of like a news night aura. So you can see people falling for it more. Whereas like falling for Ali G is like, yeah, come on, like this guy's not real.
Yeah, this can't be real.
I've got a list here of people who've been guests on the Ali G show.
All right.
Buzz Aldrin.
Right.
Whom Ali G addresses as Buzz Lightyear and asks him if he was ever jealous of Louis Armstrong. Some of this is good. Yeah. Tony Benn, David Beckham. Have we got anyone else in here worth having? Noam Chomsky. During this interview, Ali G is perplexed about the difference between the terms bilingual and bisexual. After asking if his 4-year-old part Bangladeshi and part English cousin will grow up to speak both languages. Jarvis Cocker, Paul Daniels, the magician, Mohammed El Fayed, Jesus. Newt Gingrich.
I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen has this knack for getting very politically connected people on camera. I mean, it was his thing with the... where he managed to get the footage of Rudy Giuliani thinking that he was going to sleep with, I believe, if I remember correctly, basically it was implied that he was going to have a chance to sleep with an underage sex worker and, you know, but exploited child. And he started like unzipping his fly, not realizing it was fake. And they like burst in to sort of stop it in the filming. But like, it's pretty damning. Like, Rudy Giuliani, famously not a very smart guy, but he, after all those years in the public eye, managed to be fooled by Sacha Baron Cohen. So, like, the man's he's wily.
Back to back in the list, Donald Trump and Gore Vidal. Author and essayist whom Ali G mistook for Vidal Sassoon.
Gore Vidal, yeah, he's, like, really famous American author, 20th century author, but, like, he's also sort of, like, a talk show circuit guy. Famously, he called... William F. Buckley a crypto Nazi, and Buckley said, "Stop calling me a Nazi, you queer." Like
The Trump one. In the interview lasting under 2 minutes, Ali G proposes a business idea to Trump consisting of creating ice cream gloves, to which Trump replies, "Well, it sounds like a good idea and I hope you make a lot of money," before walking off the set. They should get Trump and Ali G together now. That's something that I want to see.
Yeah. Degree of incoherence, but I don't know, I feel like when you look back on this stuff, like, do you feel as though this is, when you talk about being like of its time, I'm interested in like what specific things to you jump out. I mean, I certainly think that like the calling women bitches thing is kind of a gag. It's just one of those things where like, even if you're trying to emulate, you're trying to like mimic a kind of behavior that is real, it's kind of like juice isn't worth the squeeze at this point, because if you tried that, like like just generally, people are going to rightfully respond in a negative way to it.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, because you are British, you grew up here, like, I don't know, what do you think?
I think it's, well, I guess the charitable read of Ali G is kind of that it is like, it is sort of like universal comic trope of like, it's very funny when someone's like trying to be something that they're not.
Sure.
And the bitches thing is like, this is kind of what I mean when you see these things. They've not aged that well, but on the other hand, it is supposed to be satire. So you kind of like, I mean, like, there's a bit where he uses like a racial slur, like very much to get a rise out of people, and but it's the sort of thing where you're like, well, they wouldn't do that on television now. Like, you wouldn't, like, it's kind of,
or you'd hope at least,
that would very much be considered a juice not worth the squeeze, even if it is like, I am mocking this character for using a racial slur. It would still be like, you know, you wouldn't do it. I mean, like, there's other things in it where it's just like, it's very funny to just, and I think this is also what was great about Borat, is just like getting people to react to this character, like the bit in the Jacob Rees-Mogg one where he's like, so if you fuck my sister, like what class would the kid be? And he's like, well, I don't know anything about this young lady. And he's like yeah, you're too good for her, innit? And he's like, no, I don't know. He's like, nah, it's true, man, like even my mum says she is rank. Like this, like,
so what if I knobbed the daughter of a lord?
Yes, what if you did?
If she got a bun in the oven, what class would the little nipper be?
It's so much depend on the circumstances, depend on the girl in question, and so on and so forth.
So what if you got busy with my sister? You'd advise it, because she ain't the cleanest girl out there.
I haven't had the pleasure of meeting your sister.
Well, it can be arranged. She'll be keen.
I'm speculating on my having a relationship with somebody I've never met, and that leading to a child being born, and then as to what class it might be, is so far-fetched as to be ridiculous. I have no idea.
What, you think you're still good for my sister?
I certainly not.
You is.
No, she's rank. She's nothing.
Believe me. Even my mum cusses her, tell her she's a slut.
Or the thing where he's talking about, like, would you be upper class if you were, like, rich and owned a huge pool or something like that? And you can see Jacob Rees-Mogg is just very, like, discomfort is the overriding sensation that I see throughout it.
Yeah, more
so than his normal level of ambient discomfort.
Yeah, and that kind of, I think, there's a, being from Essex, there's definitely, like, an Ali G type that still exists, because I mean Essex is a bit less white than it used to be, but I mean it's still pretty white. And you do, I sometimes, like, you know, when I'm in Harlow, you just see like the fucking, you know, the 20 year old white guys walking around in 30 degree heat in the full tracksuit with the hood up, and it's like, who are you kidding, brother? Like, come on, like, you're from here. In a sort of I don't know, so there's, it is sort of satirizing something in British culture, but like, yeah, I don't know, it definitely, like, it's aged, it's really aged.
Yeah, I think one thing that I find interesting about looking at it now is that, maybe on the aging topic, I don't want to acknowledge how long ago it was, because I'm like, I don't feel like, you know, that old. But then you realize, like, no, this is more than 20 years ago. And like the footage kind of reveals that when you see how.
Yeah. Look how young David Beckham looks in that video.
Yes.
And that's later on, Ali G, too.
Yeah. And certainly Jacob Rees-Mogg is a good example of it. The settings and such, you can tell. But I mean, I guess looking at this stuff, I'm trying to think if we have an equivalent. And I bet you I'm just going to miss a very obvious one, because like I haven't been America-brained in so long that I can't remember. But like, I do think that, yeah, the person pretending to be someone they're not. The only thing that comes immediately to mind is like American Ali G is like the annoying white kid who's pretending to be really hood when in the movie Can't Hardly Wait, which is like a graduating from high school teen coming of age movie. It's such a pretty good movie, but from like 98, I think.
Okay.
But like that guy exists, but the idea that annoying guy gets his own TV show to go interview famous people, like, different vibe entirely, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. It's almost Ali G in reverse, but the Wayans Brothers movie, White Chicks,
is sort of
reminiscent of Ali G in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's also funny when you think about
it. Completely the opposite bit, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, man, I it's not a Wayans Brothers movie, but there was a. It's weird because, like, you talking about Bruno and just sort of like the whole thing. Like, what if a guy was gay? Where,
what is that?
Like, there were movies. Most stuff that made jokes about gay, queer, trans people in America. I mean, they're still bad, but they were really bad back then. But then every now and again,
And over here too. Don't worry.
I mean, go back and look at some of the, like, I'm sure there's like highlight in a negative sense reels of some of the shit Jon Stewart said on The Daily Show. Like, it's bad. It's not that long ago. But
I was thinking about this recently because of the we were reminded of the Little Britain Only Gay in the Village sketch, because someone described an outfit someone was wearing as a bit Little Britain and clearly referenced that sketch, and I was like, fuck yeah, that was a you know when someone really like nails what something looks like with a take that takes you so far into your, like, wow, how did you even think of that? But yes,
it was interesting to me because I was thinking about, like, racking my brain, having grown up mostly in Carmel, Indiana, for what would be like an American equivalent. And I definitely knew guys who were sort of cosplaying as being, I guess like gangster is the right way to describe it, but sort of emulating what you would describe as like kind of rapper aesthetics. I mean, like for better or worse, you know, kids I knew at school who were, you know, would drive cars with like huge rims, you know, and this is all really expensive. And these kids came from families with money. They weren't like highly functional families. Like oftentimes like shit was fucking bad at home, but their parents, you know, had money and stuff. And like, I don't know. I don't want to like pathologize
this
all of it.
This is quite an Essex vibe actually. Yeah.
But like, I remember kids with like the stupid chains and, you know, rims on their cars, and the huge sound system is a really big thing for like, in America in general, because obviously having a car is so important, but like, you know, the massive subwoofers in the back of the car that like rattled the speakers and stuff, like that's very much like not just considered like a let's be honest, like a black thing or like a rap hip hop and like black culture thing, but also like a southern thing specifically. Like when I think about music references to like, you know, knocking pictures off the wall and shit like that, like the subs being this loud in your car, it's very much like a southern thing. So here we are in emphatically not the South, in an incredibly white area, and we're having pictures knocked off the wall by these kids because the sound systems are so loud, playing like, you know, Masterpiece Ghetto D, or like you know, the second Wu-Tang album, or you know, Biggie's Life After Death, stuff like that. Extremely like late 90s vibes. And it was funny, I was thinking about it, like, and then I realized I did have a funny example. Now, it's high school, but it's funny, which is that we had a kind of program in my high school that was like a business, like teaching business development stuff in a very like basic level, but it was part of some kind of state convention thing where like you would do a business development thing, come up with an idea and like present your idea and stuff. And some kids who, my best guess is that like they took that course is just like, because it sounded easy, decided they were going to create a rap label called Tight Yo Records. And they
Tight Yo Records is very good.
And now, to my knowledge, they didn't sign any artists or produce any music. They did make some merch that they sold as part of their business thing, and you could buy a Tight Yo Records sweatshirt.
Imagine if you still had one of those.
I know, it would be amazing. But this is the thing that's really funny, was they did some, because we used to do announcements over like the school PA system every morning. You could like that, you could make announcements, and they would like, you know, if they approved them, you could put them on. And these kids,
hey, it's me, the big dog.
Yo, dog, that ride looks like shit.
We gotta sort out your ride, bro.
Yeah. So they did one where they were doing like a holiday store. And they were selling Tight Yo Records merch, and they made an announcement. And I remember, because I would have been a freshman, because these kids were all my brother's age. They were all like graduating in the class of 2000. So like I said, extremely like all the time they were in high school until the very end was the 90s. And they were like, they basically did like a parody version of a skit from a Master P record. Which I don't, this probably is not in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, I'm not very familiar with the oeuvre of Master P.
Master P was like kind of like the sort of impresario, and he was rapper, successful rapper, but he also ran a label called No Limit Records. And there's a skit on one of his albums, it might have been Ghetto D, but basically where someone calls, the idea is that someone from the label is answering the phone, and the guy's like, you know, No Limit Studios, and the guy on the phone was like, who this? And he's like, what's this rapper's forte? Who's this? And he's like, oh, it's P. He's like it's Master P. He's like, P? He's like, yeah, it is P. He's like, P, let me hear you say, And the guy goes, and he's like, this ain't no motherfucking P. And hangs up the phone. It's from the song Make Him Say at the beginning of it. And these guys did a version of that of like, yo, this is Tight Yo Records. Like, it's Santa Claus. Like, this is Santa Claus. Like, Santa Claus, let me see you say ho, ho, ho. Ho, ho, ho. Like, this ain't no Santa Claus. And it's just like, y'all haven't signed anyone. You're not a record label. You're just a bunch of white kids in Carmel, Indiana. What the fuck? And it's like, so to me.
Now you know you should have bought so much of that
merch. I would have sold all of it. Sell it through the trash future store. Fucking resurrect Tight Yo Records. Those guys all work at like fucking, I don't know, like McKenzie now or something. Or like, I don't know, like they're part of the real estate place that fucking.
We've been thinking about doing Britnology merch. And I think this is the Britnology merch.
No. Oh, God.
The Tight Yo Records hoodie.
Oh, man.
Oi, mate, are you Master P? Oi, mate, can you say,
Yeah. It's just a whole different, I mean, like, No Limit in general is such a 90s vibe for so
make
many people.
Say, ugh.
David Baddiel. Mm-hmm. I'm signed to Tight Rail Records. Yeah, man. I mean, so bringing this up, I guess I... What I'm saying is that, like, we have this character, this stock character, but because it manifests so differently, like, I think that Ali G, especially at the time when there was less... There was no social media, there was less exchange and stuff like this on the internet, it would have been unscannable. But, like, the fact that... To us. But the fact that, like... Prince Harry was teaching the Queen Mother to say Booyakasha. Like, yeah, that tells me the degree of, like, ubiquity of this show. And so I guess to me, the thing that I'm wondering is, like, looking back on it, do you think...
I forgot about Prince Harry teaching the Queen Mother to say Booyakasha.
I never fucking forgot.
At fucking Balmoral as well. Yeah, incredible.
Do you think looking back on it that, like, it goes too far? Or do you think, like, it's not really, like, it doesn't hold up? Or do you think it...
It's hard to say. I mean, it, I don't think it's one of those things where you look back on it and you're like, oh, fuck, this is bad. It's more one of those things where you look back on it and you're like, this would be done differently now. Like, it's sort of like, there's enough in it, I think, that's, like, pretty funny. Mm-hmm. And there's something to be, I think there's, you know, like, getting one over on someone like Jacob Rees-Mogg is always pretty funny.
Sure,
like that,
yeah.
That and that kind of thing of, like, there's enough good in it that it holds up in the sense of, like, you know, there's something you can take from it as a cultural product of its time. But it's not, yeah, it's not something where, like, yeah, you could do this shot for shot today and it would be great. Like, in the way that I do think that almost about Brass Eye. Or the day to day, like, they're so close to being, like, timeless in terms of, like, the kind of shit that they're satirizing is exactly the same today, or almost exactly the same, if not worse. And, like, the jokes are actually very carefully thought through. Like, when we talked about the Peter Geddon episode, it's like, it's running stuff close to the line, but also it's really directed satire at stuff that is bad.
Yeah,
And you can have a taste debate about it, but actually, the in terms of the target of the satire, it's pretty bang on. It's not like looking at stuff from the 2000s where it's like, "What if a man was gay?"
Yeah, you know? Exactly. I do think that it's interesting. I feel as though the concept of all of it is kind of getting over on the participant that they don't realize that it's fake.
Yeah,
obviously that's still a thing. I mean, you see TikToks about it, you see things like this all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But I think for someone to achieve that level of popularity, it would be very difficult for them to maintain the joke now.
Yeah.
And so in that regard,
because then you see the difference where, like, with, like, the Posh and Becks interview, like, they're obviously in on it. And what's so funny about that interview is the way that, like, it just really exposes how Victoria Beckham is very much the brains in that relationship, because, like, she is kind of, like, roasting Ali G back, and there's, like, a bit back and forth, and then whenever he asks David Beckham a question, he's like, yeah,
I guess so, yeah.
Now, Beckham, do you reckon the better the footballer you is, the fitter the girl you go out with?
Obviously.
So you is the best at footy, you know. So you get Posh. So does Sporty Spice go out with someone from Scunthorpe United?
That's horrible.
What do you mean?
That's my friend, and she's lovely.
Exactly. Why? Is he trying to say Scunthorpe is not a good team?
Yes.
That is a horrible thing to say about it.
I do think, though, that in a way, that's my favorite thing of all the ones that I watch. Maybe because, like, I just don't like intense, awkward stuff. So that's why I never really made it through more than one episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Like, it's just not a thing I enjoy. And, you know, but...
Well, because it's like, you can tell that, like, they like each other.
Yeah.
Like, the off camera, they were having a laugh, and, like, it's not like, you know...
But I think that, to me, it also kind of reveals Sacha Baron Cohen's ability as a comedian, specifically because, like, it's not just the person kind of, like, the interview subject moderating their internal discomfort or confusion with sort of, like, you know, you think about a politician, an actor, whomever, like, they've probably had lots of interviews with people who seem fucking insane or just completely stupid.
Yeah.
And that's just part of your day. But there's going to be alarm bells going off when it's this ridiculous. I think when you take that away and it's just, like, you know, them reacting and pushing back and then him having to come up with jokes that sort of, like, maintain the character, like faking out as though he's being, you know what I mean? Like, you can see that he's just good at it. And there's also some built-in jokes that were kind of funny, like him I can't remember what it was exactly. The back of his coat just says Africa and it has Italy on it. Like, like, I'm sorry. Those kinds of jokes always make me laugh.
Yeah, wear two cop. That's gonna be the back of the fucking Tight Yo Records sweater.
I'll be honest with you. One of the funniest examples of this it's impossible to find online because SEO will just defeat you. There's just no way you can get a search engine to understand what it is you're looking for. You'd have to design it yourself. And maybe this guy did that. I don't know. Or maybe it was like the best, you know, AliExpress.com find in human history.
Yeah.
But I saw a guy walking down the street. I want to say here in Hackney, but it might have been in Aldgate when we were in our old place. And he had a jacket that had a kind of like black puffy coat, and on the back had almost like airbrushed magical style artwork of like the Arc de Triomphe and Basilique de Sacré-Cœur and Eiffel Tower and like the, you know, like the River Seine and all of these famous Parisian landmarks, drawn, like I said, in kind of like a airbrushed art shirt that you buy on holiday, you know, I don't know, we buy in Florida style. And in big letters on the bottom, it said London. I'm just like, that's fucking badass. So God, I wear it a cop.
Yeah. That
can't
is
find
sick.
It. Try to find a jacket that says London with tons of Parisian shit on online. Like, I'm sorry, but the Google can't handle it.
Actually, the Britannology merch should be like that, but it's like actual stuff from London, but it's like an XL bully, you know, like some vomit outside a chip shop.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Luxury flats.
A sky pool over luxury flats, like a huge punch up between like, you know, a huge punch up in a kebab shop at 2 a.m. and underneath it, it says Paris.
Yeah. I'm going to be thinking about the Tight Yo Records merch. But what did it look like?
I mean, if I remember correctly, it was just like kind of drawn in a not like illegible graffiti style, but in that kind of like graffiti print style. Like, you know, the brand Stussy. Like it looked kind of like
pronouncing it the German way, Stussy.
Stussy. No, you know, Stussy. Like, I mean, like we'd like Stussy or Stussy. I don't know. I never remember. Stussy.
Du hast mein Stussy gefasst.
Ja. Wer will sein Stussy poppen?
Ich habe das Stussy poppen.
Ja, es ist ein echtes Stussy Popperei.
Du hast mein Stussy aufgepoppt.
Anyway, like Stussy, that style of handwriting. I just said Tight Yo. It was like Tight Yo with an exclamation point and then records underneath it. But I mean, I'm drawing on seeing it walking in the hallway, like during what we call a passing period, like when you walk between classes in like 2000. Like, this is a long time ago, but in my mind's eye, that's basically what it looked like. But awesome. But that, like I said, like they weren't a record label in anything but name.
This is fucking Tears in Rain shit, right? Like, it's like, you know, the only record of the Tight Yo Records merch that we have is your like fallible memory from like 23 years ago. That's all we can go. You know, this is how like society is lost.
I mean, similarly, the kids who were probably only 15 or 16, but just seemed older because we were. You know, me and my friend were both 14 and our voices hadn't changed yet, complaining about not having been allowed to get into the South Park movie in like August 1999. The story I've told you,
of course,
numerous times, and I've always wondered if people take it the wrong way when they hear it, because without the context of it, someone asked me once to be like, what's anti-Semitism in the Midwest like? And I'm like, the best way I could describe it is that it's ambient in a way, but with people who don't necessarily know any Jewish people.
Yeah, there's
like,
not enough Jewish people around for it to take on a directed...
There are places that are famously, like, there are, like, bigger concentrations of Jewish people in bigger cities, but Indianapolis is not really one of them. And there was two kids who had been refused entry because they were checking IDs to see the South Park movie, and you had to be 17, who couldn't get in. One was wearing, a bandana and a shirt that said, got weed in the got milk style. And all I heard was him just like, man, that's fucking Jewish. And every time I tell that, Milo's eyes light up when he hears this, like, Midwest ephemera.
It's so funny. Because it's that kind of thing where it's like, it's so disconnected from any kind of actual racial animus.
I remember a kid in class one time, because we had my first French teacher, my French 1 teacher was a Jewish American woman, and in a very kind of like late middle age, kind of like you could tell that she, if the class got too rowdy, she would probably like not be able to get control of the class again. But she'd just been doing it so long that she kind of knew how to shape it. And there was a kid who was maybe 2 years older. He was like a junior when we were freshmen, who was like big time just stoner. And she was having some conversation. He's like, "Does anybody know what language they speak in Israel?" And he's like, "Jewish." And she like got mad at him and like was gonna write him up because she thought he was like making a joke, and he just was like fucking stupid and didn't know. Like, I'm telling you, man.
Yeah, I mean,
that's what it was like. Yeah.
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I guess Indianapolis is what the Sopranos would call Elvis country.
Yeah, maybe.
That's one of my favorite bits in the whole show where he's like, yeah, they take it down to fucking Elvis country. And then he's like, what's Elvis country? He's like, place where there are no Jews, blacks, or Italians.
Yeah, sounds about... Well, I mean, I guess looking back to bring it back into the sort of thematic point here, it's funny that Sacha Baron Cohen gave a commencement speech at Harvard as Ali G. That's not really out of character for Harvard. I remember that one time they had Kermit the Frog do it.
Yeah.
And I remember a quote in some coverage of this where someone's like, I kind of feel like you bust your ass for 4 years at the school. You deserve more than getting talked to by a fucking sock. I don't necessarily think it went over well. I imagine a lot of people in the audience and their parents were very confused. Like, why does this guy talk this way? But that to me is pretty standard stuff. Looking back, I got to be real with you. It's more annoying than funny to me. But I also know that I'm not the target audience for it. In the sense that, like, this is a specifically British thing.
Well, you're also 20 years too late to be the target audience for
That's true. Yeah. But I would have been the target audience in Britain in 1999 or 2001 or whatever.
Yeah, 100%.
100%.
Yeah, yeah, you'd have had to have gotten your Uncle Dave to smuggle you into the cinema to see Ali G in the house.
Yeah, I probably... British me would be a really... I don't know, would that mean that I would like have discovered I could get an American passport and emigrate to America and do a...
Oh, I fucking love Guns N' Roses.
Doing a podcast called like Americaology, where the exact thing where American Milo is explaining America to me.
Have you ever heard of Twinkies? Okay, listen up, buddy. I'm American Andrew Tate.
Or just Andrew Tate.
Yeah. No, but he's like, Andrew Tate is still like British. Andrew Tate is like, it's like, you know, like American Andrew Tate is like, what if Andrew Tate was raised in America? You know,
I think I've told the story on the show before that in middle school.
Writing like you've never seen the fucking Brady Bunch.
That there was a kid in my middle school who his family moved over. I know I've told this story before that I had a British classmate. And his dad was a fucking Tai Bo instructor, like Billy Blake's Tai Bo, like the video, not fight, not actual martial arts, but rather just like it's like Kung Fu jazzercise. But his dad, I realized now, because they were from Coventry, and his dad like taught
the
class. It's
weird because Tai Bo is so American. Like, why is a British guy a Tai Bo? Like that kind of that's the kind of thing where it's like it's too niche.
But his
to
dad
get a
had like gelled hair and an earring and had like tracksuit joggers when he was teaching the class to like my eighth grade gym class. And I realized now that like we encountered like Coventry guy, but I just wasn't prepared for it. And that to me is kind of like encountering Ali G as an American with no context.
All right, listen up, kids. You're gonna learn about Tai Bo.
I didn't realize.
Moved to Carville, Indiana, to teach Tai Bo.
Is Coventry accent that close to the Birmingham
it's
general?
That neck of the. I mean, people are going to yell at me, but it's Coventry is near Birmingham. I guess it's like. Is Coventry in the Black Country? Oh, don't write in.
Don't fucking ask me.
No, I'm not. I'm asking the ether. But yeah, Coventry is it's the West Midlands.
Yeah,
you
understood.
Know, it's going to be
understood.
The accent's going to be somewhere in that neck of the woods.
All right.
Although I was going a bit Ringo Starr there, but
yeah, I feel like I just was asking you because I figured that you've probably been like defrauded by a shitty comedy promoter in Coventry at some point in your career.
You know, weirdly, I've never done a gig in Coventry.
Really?
And I've been to a lot of shit towns in this country. What I love sometimes is you meet someone from a shit town who doesn't work in the comedy industry, but it's like a small enough shit town that you know some cunt comedy promoter in that town, and you bring it up and they're like, that fucking cunt. And I'm like, yes, he transcends the business, and it's always a man. And like, you know that guy and you hate him too, but just from like down the pub, which is so much better. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Well, you know what? I don't know how to round this out other than saying that, it's a fragment of a different time. I don't know if it was better. I mean, there's a lot of things culturally, socially that seem like it was worse back then. But it is weird to me that I'm trying to think of like breakthrough crossover stuff, like characters, films, etc., that are British that have that kind of purchase in America, or even like any warrant any kind of mention. And I don't know, like it's prestige TV, it's some music stuff, it's certain actors, you know, things along those lines. But
yeah, I guess The Office kind of, but it was translated.
Yeah, we had to make our own version of it. Yeah, you know, yeah. it's like
the
like
soy version.
Only Fools and Horses. You know, the Serbians couldn't just dub it; they needed to invent Serbian man in van.
Yeah. I mean, which is awesome. It's so funny that they, like, in retrospect, the American Office, that they managed to make a more annoying version of a product that was made by Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
It goes to show how far Ricky Gervais has
come. I think the thing at the end of the day, it's just that some of the humor doesn't translate. And I guess I'll leave it on once again, because I'm really playing the hits today and referencing some of these stories. I'll end it on the thing about British humor and American humor. Is the best summation of this that I've ever seen was the episode of King of the Hill where Peggy tells Bobby that they're gonna watch this show, and it's British humor, and he might not find the jokes funny because British humor is more sophisticated than ours. Mm. And Bobby just goes, "Why is that man wearing a dress?"
Yeah, I mean, could anything be a more obvious rip on Monty Python?
Look, I'm just saying that some things, I think, beautiful. When you look at The Office, like the show might have been popular in like a cult way, but yeah. If you remade it for an American audience, it would be like...
I'll be saying the same thing that an Ottoman soldier once said in about 1943.
Yeah, the weirdly the... I can only imagine. You know what?
Yeah.
Good of a place as any to leave it. Thank you for being a premium subscriber, Premium Hogs. We love you.
Let me hear you say, ooh.
That ain't no motherfucking hog. Look forward to us whatever permutation of Tight Yo Records merchandise we come up with, because sometimes I just mind my memories for some strange stuff that I encountered as a
British version of Tight Yo Records is such a powerful thought. Yeah,
all I can say is I remember there was a community paper thing where they had done a story about like a teen couple that like had gotten, the girl had gotten pregnant and they'd gotten married, and there were some comments about it, and like someone wrote a letter to the editor that was like his boys in their gang called the Swayze Crew, and they said they were going to basically retaliate, implied beat up the people who had said mean things in this story about them, and like
the Swayze crew.
And so I'm just saying, like, what Ali
we
G
know
was
how to dance dirty, if you know what I mean.
What Ali G was making fun of in Britain, we have a version. It just looks different. That's all.
The Swayze crew.
Listen, as a Swayze crew, we will retaliate, and you know what? That's where we can leave it.
We run this roadhouse.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's just, yeah, we hang out. We hang out in fucking Bob Evans and make a lot of noise and don't leave a good tip.
That's right.
That's how you be a bad boy.
Yeah.
Anyway,
please come to my tour dates. End of this month in Rotterdam. Amsterdam is sold out. February 11th, special taping in London. Please come to that. There's a rehearsal for the special taping also on February the 7th. If you can't make that, which would be very helpful, I do need people to come to that so I can make sure that I know all of the words. That is cheaper if that appeals to you. March the 3rd in Brighton. We need to sell some tickets to that because I forgot to promote it early enough. Australia. I'm doing Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, Newcastle, Canberra, Adelaide, and Perth. Please come in the relevant city. That would be great. It's my tour show, Sentimental. It got 5-star reviews at the Fringe. Come along. Great to see you.
I will link Milo's site in the show notes, since this is obviously this is a bonus episode, but we'll put that there. So yeah, if you're in a position to go see Milo, buy some tickets, go see him.
Do it.
You will have all the information there.
If you're lazy, you can Google Milo Edwards city name and it's almost certainly going to work.
And I will link all of the segments of Ali G that we watched in preparation for this in the show notes as well. If you want to post comments, post your thoughts on this. What do you think?
Yeah, we didn't talk much about the movie Ali G and the House, B8, Two Rares, Bitch on a Pension, Suck My Dog, etc., etc.
God damn it. Yeah, I'm kind of glad we didn't, because I would have had to watch the movie and I think I would have come like just like bleary-eyed and furious, being like, Milo, why did you do this to me?
please cut a perfect edit of Nate saying, bitch, I would have come. I'm going to put that on the soundboard.
I don't think I actually said that, but you know what? If you can make it sound like that, then use it to your heart's content. I grant you all the privilege in the world for that. But until next time, thank you for being a premium subscriber, and we'll speak to you soon.
Catch you later.
Bitch on a pension, suck my dong.
What? Shall I turn the engine on?
Yeah.